You're with Michael Parker on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, folks, we are back. It is hour two of the program here on TNT Radio. I'm going to be joined in just a second by Benjamin Sledge, and we're going to talk about his new book as well. Before we get to that, I was thumbing through the news because I was trying to find out if the Ghislaine sentencing had happened yet, and just a quick perusal during the break. I'm still just finding the stories about it, so I don't know. I can't report on what's going on there, but I did find something that does interest me because this is summertime. I'm going to be traveling towards the end of summer, and maybe you are planning to travel for the 4th of July. Well, guess what? Delta pilots are planning on protesting nationwide for improved pay, protections, and scheduling. And you know what? I'm going to be honest. I don't blame them one bit because pilots, I mean, I can't think of anything much more important than keeping pilots happy, because I don't really like the airline industry per se. And we've covered it quite a bit on the show, just how they kind of pack us like sardines into planes. Last week, we had this situation where all the flights were canceled. More flights, I think, were canceled even yesterday. Thousands of pieces of luggage had been lost at various airports. My sister got her luggage lost. She flew to Montreal for a race up there. They lost her luggage. The Texas band Krungman, great band, all their guitars got lost. There was footage that I've mentioned a couple of times. There was a shot of a pilot in Edinburgh, Scotland, actually loading luggage onto his plane. So the point is, when we put a few hundred people onto a plane, you know, that thing is piloted by human beings, and those human beings work long hours. They have intense scheduling. So this is what they are going to strike about. They're asking for improved pay. They're asking for protections. They're asking for their scheduling to be reduced or limited. And I support them on this. So all of these off-duty pilots are going to be picketing at airports in Atlanta, LAX, JFK, and several major airports. And I would guess that by Delta doing this, that the mantle may possibly be picked up by pilots of other airlines. But I got to say, I support this. It's like, I want my pilot to be happy and to be well-rested and doing his job at the peak of his abilities. And if he is overworked and angry, then that puts the entire vessel, aircraft, in danger. So I support this. I don't know how long it's been since they've had their last pay raise, but this is an important part of the global infrastructure. And it seems like travel, along with food, along with energy, these various sectors just seem to be crumbling here in the 2020s. And you know, we could talk about why that is, but the bottom line is it just is. And travel is something that many of us do for the joy of seeing the world and the enrichment that that brings us. Many of us have to do it for work. Many of us have to want to do it to see our family. So this is crucial. We have to maintain these types of sectors within our society so that we can continue to be a 21st century society. So I'm following this, and I wish these pilots well in their proceedings. And, you know, when COVID was happening, a lot of these pilots didn't want to get the vaccinations, but they did in order to keep working. And they worked through the whole thing. And there were certain portions of our society, law enforcement, first responders. These people didn't have any choice. On the other hand, you know, we had the teaching lobby, which was quite vocal, especially here in California, about how they didn't want to return to work. Well, there's certain sectors that never had that choice. They had to work, and pilots are one of those sectors. So we owe them a lot. And I know it's easy to pick on the airline industry, but in this particular case, you know what? I support the pilots. This is TNT. You're listening to Deprogram. We'll be back in just a second with Benjamin Sledge.
We're not exactly mind readers, but
they say what I'm thinking.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right. So Now we're going to be joined by Benjamin Sledge. He is a combat veteran. He did tours in both Iraq and Afghanistan. He's a recipient of the Bronze Star, Purple Heart, two Army Commendation Medals. And, you know, I did not serve, and I take my hat off to those who did. When I was a young man, I didn't heed that call. So now I'm trying to make up for that in other ways by celebrating the people who did. And so that's part of what, you know, be it the military or be it law enforcement, I want to celebrate what those people do and the sacrifices that they have made on this show. So Benjamin, good morning, and thank you for joining me.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
Brother, I was looking over your bio and your websites. You look like one of the hardest working guys in media. I mean, holy cow, it's not enough that you're a veteran, but you're also a graphic artist. You do all kinds of things. You're a speaker, you're a writer. How do you find time for it all?
You make time for what you want to make time for. Obviously, my most important role is that of a father and a husband to my kids. But, you're kind of figuring out like how to do that stuff. And in times past, there was this kind of ideology of a Renaissance man or a polymath. And several years ago, I had heard about this guy. His name's Jason Everman. He used to be the bassist for Nirvana. Then he went over to Soundgarden. Then he became an Army Ranger. Then he went into Special Forces. And now he's getting a degree in philosophy from like Columbia University. And he read Renaissance icons like I did. And I love philosophy and theology and different things of that nature. And this Renaissance icon he quoted, he said, "A well-rounded man is a warrior, an artist, and a philosopher." And that really stuck with me. And I was like, that's the kind of guy that I want to be. I want to be well-rounded. And so I just started dabbling in everything and have just found life interesting and crazy at the same time.
Well, that is very inspiring. When you said the name, I'm like, I know that name. So my little mental Rolodex starts turning. And then, you mentioned Soundgarden and Nirvana. I was like, yes, that guy, because can you imagine that? You're playing in a rock and roll band, but you feel the call to serve, your fellow man. Wow.
Yeah. His story is absolutely wild too. Two of the biggest bands in the world, you know?
Yes. And I love both of those bands. The grunge thing to me, like, hit me perfectly. It was everything that I liked. I used to own a punk rock club in Texas in the 80s. We had Nirvana play there. We paid him $200. He wasn't in the band at that point. But anyway, so what you're talking about of being a Renaissance man, and you clearly are that because you're wearing so many hats. But let's go to the book and let's talk about your experiences serving, because let me understand this right. So you went to Iraq first, and then you went to, no, I'm sorry. You went to Afghanistan first or Iraq first? Which one?
Afghanistan first.
Okay. Afghanistan. So let's just start with that. I supported withdrawal from Afghanistan. I did not support the way it went down. And as a person, I was also reading this other article before the show today, and it was a Gallup poll because I was considering maybe bringing it up, but I'm just going to capsulize it in this context of our conversation. Gallup poll does this annual poll on just how happy or unhappy people are. And no surprise to anyone, 2022 anxiety and fear and anguish are at very high levels. And one of the most unhappy places in the world is Afghanistan. And the way we withdrew from Afghanistan, I think, is an absolute debacle, a foreign policy era of a gigantic magnitude, but you served there. So talk about Afghanistan and your feelings about all of this.
Yeah. So, this is a common question. It's, we fought there for 20 years. There were kids who, fought in Afghanistan who weren't even alive when 9/11 happened. That's pretty wild to think about. And so for me, I landed in Afghanistan in 2003, and we had just invaded Iraq. And I thought for sure, okay, well, I'm going to Iraq. And they're like, no, you're going to Afghanistan. And I get there and it's like the country kind of stopped like in the 1500s. And I end up on a small forward operating base next to the Pakistani border. And you begin to see the culture and everything else there. And at first, you know, when I went there, I was like, okay, this is why we joined the military, you know, to fight against enemies, foreign and domestic, that would try and come against us. 9/11 was a big deal. Pat Tillman left an NFL contract to become a Ranger and was unfortunately killed by friendly fire. And we believe in the cause, and we accomplished that within 6 months, basically. And if you read the Afghanistan papers and or you served over there, suddenly it becomes like, well, okay, what are we doing here? Are we stabilizing this country? Are we keeping, you know, radical terrorists out of the environment? Are we defeating Al-Qaeda? And Al-Qaeda kind of becomes like this multi-level hydra where we're chopping heads off and they just keep sprouting back. And we begin to sell Afghanistan in a myriad of ways. So like by the time I was there, like the DEA was working there and they said, they're like, oh, we got to end the poppy trade and the Silk Road and the war on drugs. So it became about that. And then I remember like coming home and they're like, we found minerals and commodities in Afghanistan. We can become rich. And so it just, the narrative consistently changed, and we never had a real clear goal exactly as far as what we were doing. And the biggest problem that we saw was that the Afghan army and people were unwilling to fight for themselves. And that's really what it boiled down to, because while the withdrawal was a complete and utter debacle and a failure in foreign policy and an international embarrassment, The real fault for me, even as much as I love and respect the Afghans, was their inability to stand and fight for themselves against the very people that wanted to take away all their livelihoods. And the reason that they're utterly unhappy is while the Taliban are now in power and have all of our $80 billion worth of weapons of war, it's the largest humanitarian crisis we're seeing everywhere. They're on the brink of famine. I work with interpreters that have gotten here stateside and institutions that are sending money just so people can eat. All the life luxuries and stability that we provided are gone. And so it explains exactly why they're unhappy. And we gave, you know, most parents give their kids 18 years under a roof. We gave them an additional 20 years, and they were unable to stand up on their own. And because of that, many Afghan veterans feel that what we did, we're like, did it have purpose? Did it have meaning? Did it matter? And in some ways we can say yes, because women never got an education there ever. They were 0 for 0 before Americans came in, and now they were able to get that. We built roads and infrastructure. We pulled them out of poverty, but unfortunately it's regressed. And so there's good things and there's bad things, but overall the way that we withdrew, and I supported the withdrawal. I think most veterans did, because we just didn't know what we were doing, but the way it went down, utter embarrassment.
Yeah, I think that, and that was like this time last year.
About a year ago.
I spoke out a lot about this at the time, because to me it was shocking. So let me ask you this, because when I think about the Afghan people, and you mentioned that it was kind of like they stopped in the 1500s, and I was going to use Stone Age people, but that's really too much of an exaggeration. But what we are talking about is people living in very dire conditions in an extremely rugged terrain. I don't know, because I don't know any of these people, but it's not hard for me to just speculate that this is something that happened to them. So the fact that they didn't take up arms and defend themselves or get their act together kind of doesn't surprise me. And I almost don't blame them to a certain extent. The Taliban, I'm not pro Taliban. So we had an opium situation there forever. Now we find out, but actually this was like 2010 or something, because I brought this point up as well, which you bring up. The other thing that bugs me about all of this, and this is going to sound capitalistic, but it's, to me, it's just strategic. We left a gigantic amount of lithium in Afghanistan. Lithium goes into batteries, into your cell phones, everything that's going to be critical for the remainder of the 21st century. A lot of those type of rare earth minerals are in Afghanistan. We just kind of left that behind. That's almost certainly going to be exploited now by China. But back to the people of Afghanistan, I don't know. When I see people in such a dire situation and in dire poverty, many not well-educated, I'm not surprised when they don't rise up perhaps to the levels that we wanted them to.
Sure. I think the thing is like my job was as a, I worked in civil affairs, which you work with a lot with the indigenous local population. You understand the geopolitics, the history, the background, the occasion of what happened there. And you have to remember that within the Afghan people, it's very tribal oriented. It's not, there is not a centralized government entity per se, or there hasn't been. It's just been people who have risen to power, and it's kind of like, let me live and I'll let you just kind of do your thing, Taliban, or whoever's in charge. And right. They just, most of the time, they just want to be left alone. It's not like where we have this nationalistic identity as Americans, where we're proud to be American. I mean, I don't know if that's the case anymore, but there's still this identity of America. And within Afghanistan, it's very fractured. There's no nationalistic identity. And so you have entire areas within Afghanistan that are completely self-governed. Waziristan is a great example. No, that place has never been conquered by any empire ever. I mean, we call Afghanistan the graveyard of empires because every single person who's walked through there from Alexander the Great to the British Empire has walked out with their tail between their legs. And we are the latest empire to do that after the Soviets.
And if I remember correctly, going back to the 80s, I think it was the Mujahideen. And they kicked the butt of the Soviets. And I think, I'm not trying to be conspiratorial, folks. This is just the way that I remember it. But I believe that the Mujahideen got help from the CIA because we saw them as like these little kind of proxy warriors against Russia. And eventually, yeah, Russia's like, you know what? We're out. This is not paying off. And I believe, if here again, I'm trying to remember all this. I think that the Mujahideen kind of mutated into a little bit of ISIS or Al-Qaeda. Is that the way it went down?
That's correct. So historical fact is that the CIA did train the Mujahideen fighters, and you just rent the movie Charlie Wilson's War and it'll kind of cover all that. But ultimately they were very fond of Americans. Like Afghan's favorite movie is Rambo 3. Funny enough, that's like the national movie. The national movie of Afghanistan. They always wanted to talk to you about Rambo 3 because Rambo goes over to Afghanistan, fights alongside the Mujahideen against the Soviets. And so there were literally places when I first went there where they still thought we were fighting the Soviets. They were like, oh, the Americans are here. Are we still fighting the Soviets? We're like, no, that ended a long time ago. But they did. The Mujahideen, unfortunately, adapted into more of the Al-Qaeda and began aligning with, the Taliban and later on ISIS and ISIL and the rest of the multi-headed hydras that we continue to cut the heads off of. And what we forget to realize is they've been fighting in those mountains for years. They know all the escape routes. They have tunnels. Like I literally would rappel into some of the caves with like a pistol. And nowadays I'm like, that was really dumb, man. I felt like one of the tunnel rats in Vietnam. And, but that they knew the terrain, they knew the landscape. And as their ideologies got warped and they begin to see the Americans as the oppressors, it turned certain aspects of them against us.
How long were you in Afghanistan?
I was there for 9 months.
9 months. And then you returned to the U.S.?
I did. I did. Took a rocket first before I got to go home.
Wait a minute. What do you mean took a rocket?
I got hit. And that's really kind of what I finished my tour, but that was really kind of the end of it for me. After that, I was like manning a radio, in Kandahar with a cast on and everything else. So, the rest of the time, I was out on the border, doing combat operations, and, Al-Qaeda and Taliban that day just decided to, hit us with a complex attack. And unfortunately myself, another guy and a young Afghan boy, got injured in the process. But, there's all types of feelings that go along with Afghanistan, and probably why sometimes I can get salty.
No, hey, this is the show to get salty on. You're actually the second veteran to have on the show who was involved in an attack and a blast, and people got very badly hurt. Some people died. So you returned to the U.S. and what was your state of mind when you returned to the U.S.?
I mean, honestly, I was pretty much a mess. Like at first it was fine. Yeah. You know, you try to cover everything up and you're just happy to be home. But the thing was, is that I had grown up in that, you know, Leave It to Beaver era of, you know, my parents came from a great family, lived in Oklahoma, and I just had a very great child and upbringing in the 80s and 90s. And suddenly I'm thrust into this environment where there's like death and destruction, and I'm seeing dead bodies and my friends get killed. And I come home and I begin to wonder, you know, who am I? What am I capable of? And it slowly for me started to disintegrate, because one minute, you know, I'm overseas and people are trying to kill me. And then the next I'm home and everybody is like, "Woo, pumpkin spice latte season." And I'm like, it was just very, very jarring experience for me. And yeah. So I didn't want to become one of those vets that didn't talk about their experience. My grandfather was a World War II veteran and rarely ever talked about anything ever, except him being General Patton's Scotch supplier, which is in the book. So if you want to know about that, you got to pick it up. But anyway, that being the case, I started talking about it a lot. But when you're in those environments, the human brain does this thing where you see it in first responders and EMTs and doctors, where you develop gallows sense humor because of the traumatic things that you're facing and you don't know how to deal with it, and your mind protects you. So you laugh about things that would normally morally disgust you. And so I would get home and I didn't have a way to explain like just all the carnage and everything that I'd been through. So, you know, I'm laughing about, you know, insurgents' heads exploding and everyone's like, "Oh, God," you know, and they do the fake smile or the body language shift, and they're trying to be polite, but that unconscious message, and this is why most veterans don't speak about it. They desperately want to, but we pick up on body language and read people so well that immediately it shut me down and communicated to me, "You're a monster." And so I stopped talking about it. And because I stuffed everything that I was going through, it all was trying to find a way to get out. And I just became more angry, more violent. You know, it was drinking. And finally, by October, I got home in February of 2004. By October 2004, my family has staged an intervention and they're like, "You need help."
Wow. This doesn't surprise me. I'm speaking with Benjamin Sledge. He is the author of Where Cowards Go to Die. We're going to take a quick break here on TNT. We're going to return to his story in just a couple minutes. My name is Michael Parker. This is Deep Program. We'll be right back.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
So many of your favorite libertarian celebrities are here at Freedom Fest. You not only get to hear them speak, you get to talk to them because our speakers are part of the action.
Freedom Fest is an amazing opportunity for freedom lovers from all over the world to meet and interact, strategize, and come up with ways to advance our principles both in the culture and within the political space.
Don't miss Freedom Fest,
the largest liberty event of the year,
July 13th to 16th at the Mirage in Las Vegas. For more information, go to freedomfest.com.
Freedom of speech, freedom of movement, freedom of choice, freedom of assembly, freedom of health. The voice of freedom is TNT Radio.
We are back. This is TNT. My show is Deep Program. I'm your host, Michael Parker. I'm speaking with Benjamin Sledge. He is the author of Where Cowards Go to Die. Benjamin, so your family staged an intervention with you. You come back. I can understand that being suddenly surrounded by people who are psyched to go to Starbucks for a season drink would seem pretty trite to you in that point of your life. Talk about that some more.
Yeah. So, I bring this up, I've brought it up in a couple interviews that I've done that, you know, one day I'm 28 years old and I'm about a year returned home from Iraq. And I wake up, you know, I'm alone in my apartment and my cat's there. And I'm like, this is nice. This is peaceful. And what I have this bolt of lightning epiphany that I have spent all of my 20s in war and in combat. And psychologically, that's where I've been for almost a decade, where it's just like, I'm preparing to go to war. I'm training to go to war. I'm thinking about war, 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 war. And yet to the rest of the American populace, it's just kind of this becomes a background hum, like a low thrumming hum that everybody just kind of ignores. And so I'm remembering, my God, there's a war going on and my friends are dying and people I know are getting deployed. And so I'm constantly thinking about it. And luckily when my parents staged the intervention, you know, I broke down the door to my girlfriend's house. I'm like threatening everybody inside. I'm super wasted. You know, and luckily my roommate, they called him in addition to like the police. And he just wrestles me to the ground and just screams at me like, what the hell is wrong with you? You know? And, then, you know, takes me home and the next day, my parents are there, friends are there. I'm like, uh-oh, I have screwed up monumentally. And so I get into counseling. And you know, this is, and I don't want to tell anybody that I'm in counseling. Cause at the time, you know, I think, oh, counseling is for weak people because of like the oxymoron of mental health in the military. But I find this really great counselor and I spend a year working through, you know, post-traumatic stress, what I've experienced, moral injury. My best friend had been killed right before I left. And so I was dealing with a lot of survivor's guilt and just didn't know how to make sense of that. And I begin to learn the tools and tactics to kind of combat that. But I also strangely find myself missing war. And it's, war is like this kind of an adrenaline high where it's simplistic. There's a mission, there's a purpose, there's camaraderie, people care about you. It's not like when you return to, you know, the civilian world and your boss is trying to make all this extra money and lets his employees catch the proverbial shrapnel in the trench, or, you know, other employees are trying to trample their way to the top. You know, there's a code of honor. I got your back, you got mine, and we're going down together. So I start missing war, and my team chief, he's in the book, his name's Paul Gonzalez. He pushes me up against a wall and he goes, "Hey man, you're going to effing Iraq with me." And I'm like, "Wait, what? We're volunteering for a deployment? Like what? You usually wait till your number gets punched." And, he basically states, "Look, dude, we're on a war in two separate fronts." He said, "I've cut a deal with our first sergeant to let you pick your own handpicked team." And he said, "If you want to wait until that number does, you do get called up and get stacked with a bunch of turds who've never deployed." He said, "That's on you. Mm-hmm. You'll get yourself killed." And so I was like, "All right, I guess I'm going to Iraq." So we end up, and this is during the surge. So this is 2006. We end up in Ramadi, Iraq, and Ramadi will go down in like the history books as kind of like the Battle of the Bulge style of environment. It's where everyone you've heard about was. It's where Chris Kyle earned his nickname, the Devil. It's where Jocko Willink and, you know, the Task Force Bruiser guys were. I was there. And so when we get there, we nicknamed it the Meat Grinder because, you know, reading all the situation reports and everything else that's going on, Ramadi accounted for half of all deaths that occurred for the United States Marine Corps from 2006 to 2007, and half of all daily attacks that were happening in the country of Iraq. So think about that. You have Baghdad, you've got Basra, you've got Mosul, you've got Taja, you've got tons of different environments where the U.S. troops are staged and attacks are happening there every day, but half of all of them are coming out of Ramadi. And so we end up in what's now known as the Battle of Ramadi, which just is insane. By the time I leave there, my four-man team has 5 bronze stars and 2 of them have valor devices for heroism in combat. I mean, it was just, you didn't really have to prove much of yourself there. You would just walk outside the gate and get shot and stuck inside an environment where you're fighting for your life.
Let's roll back just a little bit. I'm intrigued by the feeling.
Right.
Having not served and been through all of this nightmarish aspects, I can only imagine, but I do, when you said that you missed the battle, I feel mm-hmm. that, because I can see that there's a sense, you mentioned camaraderie, you mentioned there's like a sense of purpose, the adrenaline rush, which is like, I mean, I can only imagine, because when you come back here to the U.S. and you're trying to just work into everyday life and trying to find your way after having been involved in something where every day you're trying to survive and you're depending on people that you love, your friends and your fellow soldiers, I can, in a weird way, as strange as that is, I think that I understand it.
Yeah. And I missed that. I jumped ahead. The reason why I went back is because it's what I knew. And after, yep. you know, the intervention and everything, and I'm missing the guys, I'm missing that simplicity. Yep. I don't have to worry about cell phones or school or, you know, dating or any of that stuff or social media, none of that. Like yeah. I turned my phone off for a year and I'm free to just have this simple mission. And that thrill and that adrenaline of knowing I could catch a bullet and it might be my last, but it made life grand and exciting at the same time. And there's a problem with those of us who've served, you know, your parents, when you're kids, they're like, if all your friends were jumping off bridges, would you do it? And of course the rhetorical, you know, answer is supposed to be no, mom and dad, I wouldn't do that. But if it's your veteran buddies that you served overseas with, that you're like, oh yeah, I'll follow you into the abyss. No problem. Let's jump off this bridge together. So yes. That's really what happened for me is I saw them going. I knew that I had to be with my men and the people that I'd served in Afghanistan with. And I went in that direction, and man, it really cost me everything. And I went through a very dark time after I got home.
So when they say just intervention, you're going through counseling. So do you get completely sober?
Yeah. So, well, no, yep. no, not like that. I'm still drinking during that time period.
Right. Okay.
But I'm going through counseling for like post-traumatic stress. Now, granted, yep. I stop, and really it wasn't until I got back from Iraq, cause I was burying all my emotions in like alcohol, that yep. I stopped binge drinking. I learned temperance and moderation and what that looks like to like, what does it look like to go have a glass of wine with dinner kind of thing, as opposed to like, let's pick up a 30 pack of Key Light and like not think about dead bodies, you know? And that's really what I was doing. And that's what many of us who have seen the worst parts of combat will do, is we want a way to escape, and alcohol or drugs kind of become that toxic mm-hmm. escape for us. And instead I had to learn to confront my emotions, the trauma, and my past demons.
You mentioned that your grandfather served. Did you grow up wanting to serve, or did you just feel called when 9/11 and all of this happened? Did you come from a family tradition where we serve, or was this just coming yeah. from you?
Yeah. So there's a joke. It runs in the blood, is what we say, if you have a family mm-hmm. history of military service. So my yeah. grandmother, who's 96, she's still alive. She's listening to the book right now because she can't see anymore. She's traced our family lineage and service back to a general under Napoleon. So we come from a very long lineage of military history. And I know that my great grandfather, her father, served in World War I. My grandfather was a paratrooper with the 82nd Airborne, and missed the D-Day jump because he caught pneumonia, and then got transferred to Patton's Third Army over in Germany. and ended up becoming a, you know, Scotch supplier there. My other grandfather served stateside during World War II, but his brother, my great uncle, stormed the beaches in the Pacific. Both my uncles served in the Army during the Vietnam era, were never deployed. And then it skipped over my dad, although he tried to enlist in the Air Force, but was disbarred because of his asthma. And then my brother and I both enlisted. He was a combat medic, and then I worked in sections of, you know, civil affairs and psychological operations command. And so everyone's like, are your kids going to join? I was like, I don't know, but it's in their blood. So the reason why is I felt a call to simplify it a little bit. I felt that call, but I also came from a lower middle class family. And both my parents had gone to college, but you know, they were in debt. They didn't have savings. And they were like, well, you're going to go to college. And I was like, well, how do we go to college if we don't have the money for it? And they're like, well, you know, figure it out. And I was like, well, military. Mm-hmm. And, at the time I joined in 1999 when Bill Clinton was president, you know, so a different, totally different army back then. It was like strikes, like Bill Murray. Everyone's like, you know, barbecuing and having fun. And then 9/11 happens, just totally shifts everything.
Yeah.
But, you know, selfishly and narcissistically, I was like, well, you know, and I was this metal kid growing up. I liked the goth culture and bands like Metallica, Sepultura and Slayer. Every single chapter of my book is actually named after a metal song. But that was my background. And because of it, I was very ostracized, picked on. I had like really long hair, you know, I was in the JNCO jeans and the band t-shirts. And, I was like, well, I do know that women love a man in uniform, so that'll help too, you know? And so I enlist, and then the rest just became history. Once September 11th happened, I mean, it was game over. It was just war.
Everything you say makes sense to me. So I get it. I was just curious, you know, how that came to be. So let's return back to Iraq. So you get there and it's the meat grinder. It's Ramadi. It's just as bad as it could possibly be. How long are you there and when do you come back?
Oh, let's see. I think we were there a little over a year, like close to, I think, 13 or 14 months, actually in country, but we had spent a year and a half training beforehand. So we were just gone.
Okay. So where does the training occur?
So multiple places. So we go to JRTC, Joint Readiness Training Center in Fort Polk, Louisiana. It's where you're kind of doing a fake war environment. So we're there. Then we go to Fort Dix, New Jersey to train there. Then we're out at Fort Bragg, North Carolina to train there, which is where the United States Special Operations Command is and the Civil Affairs and Psychological Operations Command. So we're out there training. And then finally you go overseas.
All right. And so when you're in the fog of war, is it just, cause I can't imagine, is it like a psychedelic experience? Because I mean, I'm picturing chaos, extremely loud sounds, no real schedule, just surviving.
Yeah. I tell people this, I said, this is the hard part about the movies, the war movies, is sometimes they're accurate. Like really accurate. So like Black Hawk Down, there's this scene, you know, where the dude gets hit with like an RPG explodes next to him. And there's just this incessant buzzing and it sounds like he's underwater. And it's that way. And then also at the same time, nobody really has a clue what you're doing, what you're really doing. It's just your muscle memory takes over and you just, you begin to remember to follow your training. And so I tell people this, this is the thing that a lot of people miss. War is actually a very spiritual experience. And people are like, wait, explain that. When most of us think we know what's going to happen after we die, you know, regardless of our religious beliefs, you know, do I end up in heaven with Jesus or in paradise, or is it a cycle of reincarnation and nirvana, or is it the great nothingness? You know, we all think we have some semblance of knowing like what's going to happen after we die, but the reality is there is no formative consensus on this. It's a guess in the dark, even regardless of my own personal and religious convictions. But when you point an M4 carbine rifle at a man and you pull the trigger, you're going to send him into the great unknown. And on many levels, it's like playing God. And there's something deeply spiritual about that, because you have the power to protect life or take it away. And so you really have to deal with the ramifications of that and that experience. You have to deal with, so yeah, it's like, it's psychedelic and trippy in some ways, but also at the same time, there's these questions of morality, of existentialism, you know, like what's my purpose and meaning here as a human being? You have to deal with the emotional and the physical side of everything. But when you're in those moments of combat, you're not really thinking about those questions. Those questions become later. In the moment, you are just simply trying to survive and make sure, and really, it's not even you're trying to survive. You want to make sure that the person to your left and your right survive. And so you'll gladly give your life in order to ensure that they come home. And so there's this sense of connectedness to people that I've never experienced anywhere else.
Everything you're saying to me, again, it makes sense. It resonates. When you said it was a spiritual thing, that makes sense again, because typically here in the US, we go about our lives, we buy our pumpkin spice coffee and we get our job and we pay our car payments. We do not contemplate our own mortality day in and day out and the impacts that we have on others. This is Benjamin Sledge. We are going to take a quick break. He is the author of Where Cowards Go to Die, Its Streets here in the U.S. on July 5th. We're lucky to have him on, and we thank him for his service. This is TNT. We'll be right back.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
More than 1 million voters across 43 US states have switched to the Republican Party over the last year, according to voter registration data analyzed by the Associated Press. ABC 30 Action News stated that nowhere is the shift more pronounced and dangerous for Democrats than in the suburbs, where well-educated swing voters who turned against Trump's Republican Party in recent years appear to be swinging back. Liberal elites who class themselves as well-educated are now wringing their hands in despair that so many university-educated voters would be joining the deplorables. How could they? But perhaps it is they who lack a proper education and real-world experience. It is this state of affairs which will ensure the midterm election results will somewhat reflect natural law, as opposed to the system of arbitrary rules imposed on the masses by the liberal elites. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
St. Joseph's Indian School is much more than a school for Native American children.
It's like a family. Classes are fun here. I am learning about my culture.
Since 1927, St. Joseph's Indian School has provided children the education, health care, and support they need to succeed. To help give our kids brighter futures, learn more at stjo.org today.
For the news and views you can't hear anywhere else, it's TNT Radio.
This is the program. I am Michael Parker. I'm speaking with Benjamin Sledge. He is a vet, and he is the author of a new book called Cowards Go to Die, which comes out on July 5th, the day after our Independence Day. In this final segment, Benjamin, I want to talk about when you returned from Iraq, what was your life like, and your book coming out on the 5th, the day after Independence Day. I want to talk about that as well, how your fellow vets feel these days. But let's just pick it up. You return to the U.S. from Iraq after this insane experience.
Yeah, so this is where it gets difficult. So I start hanging out with this priest while I'm in Iraq. And at the time, I don't really believe in much. But he just, you know, he seems like this really interesting guy. He's this Vietnam veteran too. He'd been wounded in the Tet Offensive. He was one of six guys to survive. And I was like, how'd you become a priest? He said, well, I told God that I would serve him if he got me out of this. And I did.
Damn
and
right.
The dude was just incredible, an incredible guy. Sadly, he died by suicide shortly after returning home. He just, you know, his own personal demons he couldn't deal with. And I mean, he was having to take care of everybody else's stuff and nobody ever took care of him. But, you know, start hanging around this guy. And part of the reason why is my wife at the time, she's Catholic, and she leaves while I'm in Iraq. You know, a lot of faults were really mine. I know that, like, for a lot of people who are hearing this are going to be like, oh God, how could you do that? And I get that. And I understand that, but I was always running off to war. I had my own problems. I made everything about me. Mm-hmm. You know, she probably lived through a lot of hell just being yeah. with me. And so I come home, I'm divorced. And you know, she's bought this house in Houston, Texas, so that she can be close to her family. And I have this house that I don't really know. I don't have a job anymore because I'm transitioning to back to this reserve status. And I'm like, oh God, what do I do with my life? And, you know, I really seriously start contemplating, suicide. And, luckily one of my best friends calls, I just reactivated my phone and he's like, yo, come stay with me in Austin, Texas. He had moved there after he graduated from college. So I drive through the night, and get, you know, show up at his place and then end up like living on his couch for a month. And, he can just like really tell that I'm getting worse. And you know, I'm trying to hide all my emotions, like I'm crying in the shower so he won't hear, and he totally heard me. And trying to sort through like my life. And for me, what begins is a series of exploring like the human condition. He's an atheist, but he takes me to church. And I start to connect with these guys there who really begin to open up about their lives and the suffering that they've been through and the experience that they faced. And one of the guys, you know, his parents had died in rapid succession within 3 months. You know, his dad was an alcoholic. And so he felt very conflicted about how much he loved his dad, but hated his dad. And then his parents were hoarders. And so there's a lot of intense shame and emotional, you know, trauma from his past growing up. And then like his marriage is suffering. And so he ends up in counseling. And this is the same time where I'm like, counseling is if you can't hack it. But he begins to share about this process and like what he's going through and what he's learning. And it just really opened me up. And I began to explore those questions of you know, everything from, you know, my purpose as a human being to the spiritual components of war. And he invites this other guy into my life and they just really begin to pour into my life. And I start doing counseling and going through a 12 step, not for like alcohol or drugs or anything at that point, because I'd already tapered off the binge drinking, but that I realized what the reason I went through 12 step was because the same reason my friend went through it. I hated myself. Mm-hmm. I hated the person that I had become. And there were all these flaws in these areas that I couldn't forgive about myself. And so the funny thing is about all the war novels and books is that they always end like at the end of the deployment. They don't tell what happens 10 years after the event or the struggles that you continue to face or the things that you continue to deal with. And the wars were still ongoing. So I was living my life, and eventually I got out of the military as a civilian, but I was haunted by these memories that I would have. And I never talked to anybody about war or combat because of what I had experienced after that first deployment. And I was in a coffee shop one day, and one of my friends, his name's Andrew, he looks at me, and it's like 6 a.m, you know, we're hanging out. I'm up as an early riser. He goes, Sledge, because everybody calls me by my last name. I sound like a G.I. Joe character, you know, Sergeant Sledge.
It's a perfect name, man. It's for your character. That's fantastic.
Yeah. He goes, Sledge, I know you fought in both wars. I've seen the medals on your wall. He said, but aside from that, I know nothing. You never talk about it. And it was kind of this real big moment for me. It was like, yeah, I don't, you know, and he was part of this entity at the University of Texas, which was getting veterans to tell their story to where civilians would listen. And one of my buddies from Iraq started writing down his experiences just on like a WordPress blog because he wanted his kids to know what happened to him over there. You know, he didn't want the stories to be lost. And so one day I decide I'm going to write an article. And by this point, I'd become a writer and it amassed a following of about 40,000 people online. And I write this article. It goes viral. It's called The Conversation We Refuse to Have About War and Our Veterans. And it gets picked up by everybody. And people start talking about it. I'm talking about the moral quagmires and dilemmas we face after we come home and step off the battlefield, and how we really long for peace because we've had to deal with the deepest wounds of war and the scars that we encounter. And so my editor at the publication Medium, I asked her one day, I say, "Hey, what do you guys want me to write on?" And she says, "Well, we love your stuff about war." And I was like, "I'm not writing about that stuff. What the heck? No, that was like a one-off." And, you know, you got to remember, this is like a left-leaning publication. And I'm like, "Why do you guys want to hear about war?" Like, And so I rebuff her and she goes, "Well, that's a travesty." And I was like, what do you mean by that? And she said, "Look," and she's a Black woman. She goes, "You're the smallest minority in the United States." She goes, "Less than 1% of you have fought in the longest running wars in the history of the United States." She said, "You come home and you all stay silent. And we can't understand the complexity, the barbarity, or the humanity of the things that you've gone through." And she goes, "The travesty is we're losing these areas that we need to connect with you, no matter how horrible they are. And because you won't talk about it," she goes, "we're losing those stories to the annals of history." And she goes, "That's the travesty." And I was like, "Oh, she's right. Crap, you know?"
Yeah.
And
yes, she is. Totally right. Well, and the whole time you're telling, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and so I started writing and I realized that the stories about Iraq and Afghanistan are really broken right now. Like our joke inside the book industry right now is if you're a Navy SEAL, you get a book deal, you know, this kind of rhymey thing. And that's not to knock my friend. I have friends who are Navy SEALs. They're fantastic people. But a lot of the stories have just been about combat or heroic exploits or some, you know, kind of jingoistic tale that doesn't encompass like what the average grunt or average soldier or Marine or airman or sailor went through during their time overseas. And then what it's like to transition out of that environment and begin to share those stories with other people, even if you carry those significant soul wounds yourself.
Benjamin, I'm in Los Angeles, and we talk a lot on the show about the homelessness and the mental illness, and we have so many veterans that are now on the streets or they have mental issues or both. And I echo the importance of hearing these stories and how do we address these people who served. So the rest of us could stay here and drink lattes and everything. How do we help these people who carry the wounds that you carry, the mental wounds, and how do we help them out? And I know that you do that. I know that you you help with therapy for veterans.
Yeah. So after I got out the military, I first worked in like geopolitical intelligence. And then I moved over to nonprofit mental health because I saw what was happening. You know, at one point we were having 22 veterans take their lives daily.
Yes.
And, you know, it's down to 17.6 now. It's still astronomical. It's still the largest number. You have this homelessness crisis among us because, again, we feel that the world and the civilian populace that we fought for doesn't understand us anymore. And going to that point about, you know, July 4th and the cost of freedom, I mean, think about this. For 20 years, we gave the American populace the freedom to not deal with combat or war or future terrorist attacks or any of that stuff. No draft whatsoever. Longest running wars in the history of the United States. 0.86% of the population served in Iraq and Afghanistan, 0.86. In Vietnam, it was 7%. In World War II, it was 11%. we have no collective buy-in. And so what happened was, is we allowed people to enjoy their freedoms, enjoy, you know, consumeristic and materialistic behaviors. And we fought for that so that they didn't have to deal with that horror. And then we come home to a country that no longer feels like home. And we either end up taking ourselves out or we end up on the streets because we don't know how to process what we've been through and what we've dealt with. And really, we've got to begin having those conversations. And the way that we do that is by bridging the civilian-soldier divide. And the misconception, I hear it so often, is like, oh, veterans only want to talk to other veterans. That's not true. We want to talk about our experiences. It's just the way that other people, we read your body language. We read what it is that you're saying. And so the same way that you would support a friend going through an extremely traumatic breakup, you wouldn't be like, well, if you didn't date that person or you didn't enlist or whatever, or you know, tell me about the worst thing happening right now. Instead, it's just simply being there. It's that gift of presence. And it's that vulnerability of opening yourself up and sharing your story too, because suffering is a language that we all speak. And so because of that, the more that we, that civilians really begin to kind of bridge that gap and help us decompress. And what we need is just better help. We don't need more of it. We just need better help, because we've already spent $92 billion since 2012 helping veterans, and there's 50,000 veteran nonprofits. Instead, what we need is better help to help our veterans transition into the people that they're meant to be.
Benjamin, thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, Benjamin Sledge, they're about to cut me off. Thank you so much for your service. I got to have you back. I could tell you are a bro. Thank you for what you've done. Ladies and gentlemen, go get the book, Where Cowards Go to Die.